Reshma Saujani is a lawyer, author, and first Indian American woman ever to run for Congress. She's the founder of Girls Who Code and the founder and CEO of the Marshall Plan for Moms. Her books include Girls Who Code, Learn to Code, and Change the World, and Pay Up, The Future of Women and Work, and Why It's Different Than You Think. Sky Perryman is president and CEO of Democracy Forward, a national legal organization dedicated to using the law and regulatory process to advance progress for people and communities in the United States. An accomplished attorney, strategist, and advocate, her work has been widely recognized for its positive impact on people and communities. Sky sits on several boards, including that of Interfaith Alliance. Sky, Reshma, this is such an important conversation to be having right now, and in your hands, such an empowering one. Thank you for taking this time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for thanks for having
me. So, Reshma, you have just been through an experience that I would love for you to walk us through about censorship and what it indicates about this moment that we're living through in our democracy.
Yeah, I mean, I just pretty much had the wildest week, I feel like, of my life in a long time. I woke up last Saturday morning. I'm like sitting there with my baby, you know, watching a RoboPolice. And, you know, I'm looking at my phone and, you know, there's a news alert saying that our Girls Who Code books were banned. And, you know, I was shocked. I had almost like 5 years ago, you know, wrote a series of books that were essentially about, you know, inspiring more girls to learn how to code. I like travel all across the country and I'd go into like these rural areas and people would say, well, I don't have Wi-Fi. You know, I don't have a device at home for my kid. How does my kid learn how to code? Is there a book? And there wasn't a book. And so Girls Who Code, you know, made them, wrote them, you know, worked in partnership, you know, with a handful of authors. And we put them out there. And, you know, we have 10,000 Girls Who Code clubs across the country. So they were everywhere. And so I read that they're banned. And I'm like, no, this can't be right. Like, why would anyone ban books about teaching girls to code? Sure enough, you know, PEN America had done this incredible survey. And they have a whole, like, spreadsheet. I looked and I saw Girls Who Code books banned, Central York, you know what I mean? Pennsylvania. And so I spent a couple of days trying to understand what happened, like texted the, emailed the teachers, DM'd them, said, you know, the school district, like, you know, crickets, except from these handful of teachers and students who had basically led, led an effort to get these books unbanned. And then, you know, wake up kind of Monday morning after learning that they were unbanned, you know, from the school district, then sending it, a tweet saying, well, actually, we never banned them in the first place. And so then we had to then spend 3 or 4 days going back, you know, debating the definition of a ban, getting the school district to actually admit that they banned them. Because, again, you know, like a lot of schools, you know, post the murder of George Floyd, a group of amazing teachers had come up with a list of resources that they thought the community, that the students, you know, would benefit from, you know, that were for diversity. The school board decides to ban the books that are on, you know, this resource list, one of which were Girls Who Code, and they're banned essentially for, you know, during the pandemic. And then a group of students and teachers basically work again to unban the books. And so it was this, you know, but the school, you know, so this was an example actually of a school doing the right thing, you know, and learning from its mistake and the community getting involved and but instead of saying, yes, we banned the books, we shouldn't have banned them, we made a mistake, we unbanned them, we'll do better next time, they wanted to revert back to the lie. And so it was just this kind of really intense week of really understanding, one, I think, and Sky and I talked about this earlier, one, it's just, I'm a lawyer, I didn't realize that books could legally be banned. And so what is happening in school districts across the country is some parents, you know, on the right, are challenging books, and not just about, like, you know, about LGBTQ, about race, about gender, you know, and school boards are allowing those challenges to go through, and then no one is coming back to litigate on them. And so for a lot of, and I think what was so deeply disturbing about this is that, you know, in this conversation about CRT, people have talked about, you know, the books are being banned because we don't want white kids to feel like they're responsible for everything bad that's happened in the universe. But when you look at the books that are banned, these are books that were written for our kids. these are books that were written for Black girls, brown girls, so that they can be present, you know what I mean, and see themselves. And that was what was just mind-blowing for me.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you almost could stop with, like, they're banning books, because the idea that there's like an appropriate book that, you know, I mean,
that should be banned.
Just to start there. I mean, but then as you get into the nuance of it, and I think one of the things that I think this gets to very much like the conversation that we had in the first segment of this show, which was like, there's a certain segment of legitimate discourse set by white Christian men, and then there's everything else that's up suspect for being like what is possible. And I think using this, the banning books is such a kind of out there, it feels like, isn't that what happened in Nazi Germany? Like, what does it mean to ban a book? But then this is happening, and we're restricting discourse, which is, I think, very much connected to Christian nationalism. Sky, I'd love to bring you in as someone who's really concerned about the law and democracy, but also like as someone who's concerned about the rise of Christian nationalism and how it's playing out in subtle but significant ways in our society.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I Reshma said is so right in terms of what we see, which is not just an effort that is incredibly concerning from anybody that cares about democracy to limit expression and education and curriculum and free, you know, marketplace of ideas, but also to deny that there is a movement to do that. And we see that, by the way, across a range of issues, not just on book censorship, but on healthcare, on workers' rights and the environment. There's always now this refrain from this certain segment of society, oh no, we're really not doing this. And you're, you know, pointing to someone that's trying to advocate for free expression, democracy, you know, you're just a unhinged activist, right? We see this gaslighting of people who are really just trying to make their communities better and to protect our country and our democracy during this time. And so I was really glad you were going to feature this topic on State of Belief, because I do think it's related to this religious right fundamentalism and Christian nationalism that we see throughout this rise throughout the country. At Democracy Forward, we've been filing public records requests in many communities throughout the country to learn what's happening. We're seeing some officials have started even trying to delete records of what they're doing. And so we're looking to challenge that, as well as to get to the bottom of this in state and local communities, because we do know that the majority of people in this country and the majority of parents in this country want their kids to get good, fulsome education, and that this is really a movement that's seeking to ban books. It doesn't represent the majority of people. It doesn't represent American democracy, but it has gained a real outsized amount of political power. So thank you for making space for this on your show.
I am curious for both of you, as trained lawyers and also as women who are committed to abortion rights for women who want to have an abortion, and other gender issues. I mean, you know, Reshma, what you're doing right now with Pay Up and with Marshall Plan for Moms, it does seem like there's a way in which the conversation is circumscribed by a certain legitimate discourse, and then when you're outside of that discourse, you're suspect. And I just am wondering, like, how does gender fit into the conversation about Christian nationalism and the broader conversation about what is okay, and then maybe a little bit more about how the law can be. It's a double-edged sword, isn't it, right now? So curious how you're reading this moment with the work you're doing on gender, Reshma,
yeah,
and specifically with Marshall Plan for Moms.
Well, I think we're in the middle of a war on women, period. I mean, you just saw millions of women pushed out of their workplace in the pandemic because we're a country that doesn't have paid leave or affordable childcare. And so women are constantly navigating their roles as mothers and as workers, and talk about gaslighting. You know, again, you know, we're, you know, we don't respect in many ways, you know, the importance of motherhood and provide the resources and support and policies to support American moms. And then that was bad enough. But then the Dobbs decision came out. And so we entered a period of now forcing birth. So we're forcing birth in a country, right, that has high rates of infant mortality for women of color, that, again, doesn't have paid leave, that doesn't have affordable childcare. And so, it's so interconnected. And so we were in a period of, you know, again, you know, forcing control over people's bodies, which is like a fundamental right. What I saw with this book banning stuff is like, and now we're trying to, you know, again, force what they do with their minds. So it's like full circle, right? Like, I am not going to give you access to information about what choices you can make, whether you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a coder or an engineer, or so that you don't have control over what your mind thinks anymore. In addition to, I'm going to take control over your body. And the other kind of thing that's happening, as you know, in the background too, is that they're trying to get rid of sex education in the schools. And so again, it's all interconnected to controlling women and controlling their choices. And we have got to have our eyes wide open about this.
That is exactly right. And it's, you know, it is what's so disturbing about it is, especially it's under the guise of protecting, you know, it's protecting the children, protecting women. And, you know, there's like an elevation of motherhood, I think, in a lot of conservative Christian and other religious traditions. And yet there's no dedication to recognizing what mothers actually need when they choose to have children, including what you're working on, Reshma, so, you know, diligently, is, you know, maternity leave and equal pay, all these things. There's no commitment to that. It's lip service.
Yeah, it's not even on their agenda. I mean, there's an extreme movement of under the guise of parents' rights that is happening on the right, which is really about, again, the quote, protection of our children. None of what's in that agenda is about, you know, again, the resources and the support that people need when they become parents. And again, I think it's we have to be very, very, very critical, you know, and about the dishonesty, you know what I mean, of how we use, how they on the right use these terms.
Yeah, I think, you know, Sky, you and I were together when Texas decided to not release maternity mortality rates. And that just seemed to me like, again, it's like, okay, we're not going to let you have the information to get the full picture of what's going on. How does that fit in? Like, that just seems like it's just one example of how there's a curtailing of information in order to put forth an agenda.
Which is exactly what we see. So in the maternal health context, you're correct. I mean, states like Texas are not releasing data as they're required to by law. They're not expanding Medicaid, which every public health advocate and every expert in the country would say is a critical thing that needs to happen in order to reduce the preventable maternal mortality rates. And so you do have people turning a blind eye to women and moms at the same time trying to wrap themselves in this family rhetoric, which is just, it's false and it's misleading. But I think that what you both are tapping into, it really comes back to the censorship piece too, which is that there is an effort now to deprive people of facts and evidence, but also of history. So we know in the women's rights context that the history that the Supreme Court, the Justices Alito's opinion went through with respect to early American life in the context of abortion was not accurate, right? And that for the work you do, Paul, that many religious traditions have supported reproductive autonomy and the rights of for, you know, people in their bodies for many years. This was not a religious movement that it was not something that began as a religious movement in the country, but something that religious fundamentalism sort of took over as a messaging piece. And so I think we now see that, whether it's on healthcare or on teaching proper history around race and gender, or even now what Russians do on STEM and science and evidence and how we can make sure that we're equipping the next generation of people to have opportunity in this world that is moving very quickly. And we need our kids to be able to not only keep up, but to thrive and to lead. And so it's all so interconnected. And I think is connected to this very fundamentalist movement, Paul, that you've been, a leader in pushing back against it at the Interfaith Alliance. So
I'm Paul Rauschenbusch. Reshma Saujani and Sky Perryman are with me as we continue our urgent discussion of Christian nationalism as an existential threat to our society and to democracy itself. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the Supreme Court and just the kind of the last 6 months and going forward. Both of you are supremely talented lawyers and have a perspective on that, specifically as women and as women who are interested in issues of equity and trying to understand what it means to have a just country that moves forward. Any thoughts about not only Dobbs, but also Kennedy and some of the other recent court cases that we've had? And maybe some of the ways, Skye, if you could take this, what are the ways that the law can be our friend? Because right now it just does not feel like it's our friend.
Well, look, representation matters. And even when we look at things and see the bleakness, we know that people engaging with the law, whether they're lawyers or not, is incredibly important. And so one I would say is that we've got to see the law and the courts as a front line in the battle for democracy, not just as a backstop. So for too long, so many people that are concerned about democracy and progress have looked at the courts as the last resort of where you go when bad actors are doing bad things to try to get them to stop. And we have to use the courts that way. And in fact, that's what they should be. And, we hope that judges would agree with that, but that is what they should be under our Constitution. But we also have to dream bigger and look for what the promise of democracy really is and seek to create that through our laws, whether that is through legislation and community involvement and a lot of the work that Reshma's leading, or work to create the law in new ways to make sure that it's fulfilling the ultimate promise of democracy and the ultimate promise under our Constitution. And I think about your great-grandfather, Justice Brandeis, in doing that. Justice Brandeis was seen as a lion of the law in so many ways, but he dissented a lot of the time. And what we saw was that his dissents really did form the basis of a people-centered jurisprudence that was able to carry forward rights. And we're back in a place where that type of legal work is needed, but also it's people work. And you don't have to be a lawyer to do that work. And so so that's sort of, it's not, it's realistic optimism. I think it's not, overly optimistic about where we're going to be in the next few years, but I think we have to not cede this ground, because right. They have shown since Dobbs, what we have seen is that the right wing is not stopping at that. And this is just a stop on a way to a much more regressive and dark place for people and communities. And so we have to get in and push back.
Yeah, and forward. That's so powerful, Skye. And I think they've made their targets clear. To not read the Dobbs decision and Clarence Thomas's, opinion and not say, yes, they're coming for contraception and same-sex marriage and interracial marriage. It's they've made it very clear that if the right did not exist at the founding of the country, it does not exist. And so we have to be smarter. Like, what do they say? It's like when people show you who you are, believe them, right? It's like we have to, like, they're telling you. And it's the same thing, Skye. You made this point to me too that was so powerful about we have to start using the courts as our friend as well. When you see something, for example, happen yesterday in Florida where athletes have to show their menstruation data to basically play sports, the first instinct for us should be on the left to sue them, right? And right. The fact that when the book ban started happening 2 years ago, every single one of those school districts should have been sued. And so there's no way that we can't keep establishing precedent unless we use the power of the law as our friend. And we have so many incredible lawyers on our side, that right. and the law supports the arguments that we're making. So it actually tactically doesn't make sense, right? That we're not actually using this as an arsenal in our tools. So I'm so grateful for Skye and the work, that they're doing at Democracy Forward, right? For building this army and looking to not just not always playing defense, but playing offense.
Yes.
Yes. I read what the parents' rights groups are talking about in their blogs. So I'm like, oh, you're coming after sex education. I see you. You know what I mean? And we got to go there before they get there.
Right. I think that's so helpful.
We can't fall into the trap of letting people say that we're overreacting, because that's what people did for women's rights advocates for many years. You're overreacting. Roe has set a law. It'll never be overturned. You know, it's what Reshma said, you know, when people show you who they are, we do need to believe them, and we need to be prepared, because our kids, really the futures depend on it.
Right. And also the framing the debate. Oh, we're just protecting children. You know, that. Oh, okay, so they've already, like, if we let them have that, you know, but that's not what they're doing. They're actually stunting children from not allowing them to fully learn and grow. Yeah. So, like, how do we also think about in messaging, and how do we also recognize that, you know, I just want to urge the lawyers out there to recognize that religion is also on your side, that the majority of religious communities do not support the Dobbs decision. The majority of the religious communities do not support rolling back same-sex marriage. The majority of religious communities would support the freedom of expression and information that comes from Girls Who Code books. And so I want us to make sure that we lean into the actual majority that we represent, and no longer feel like we're some sort of we're not the fringe. We're actually the majority, and we're trying to protect the majority rights, as opposed to allowing a thin slice of America, which is what we're seeing now represented in the Supreme Court, dictate to the rest of us what morality is, what we're allowed to learn, what we're allowed to do. I did want to just sounds dire, but it's not all dire. And one of the things that's not dire is the seating of Justice Jackson. And Reshma, I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about your experience of you were in the room, which is, you know, just was such a great honor. And if you could just talk a little bit about what that experience was like and how that might inspire the rest of us.
I mean, it was a huge honor to be in the room. To me, it was just a demonstration of how democracy works. You know, to watch Justice Jackson take her seat next to Brett Kavanaugh, all the Supreme Court justices were in the room, and you know, it gave me hope. You know, to see so many people of color, you know, so many Black people in the courtroom watching history, you know, and the seeing the first Black woman on, you know, take her seat on the Supreme Court was just, this is when democracy works. And so we have to keep fighting, you know, for those moments, because I do think, you know, I do think that justice is on our side.
That justice is on our side.
I do think that, going back to what you said before, you know, what we're fighting against is the fringe. Even when I think about what I experienced last week, the vast majority of parents did not want those books banned. But these 5-6 parents were really loud and really aggressive. And it's almost like what they say about the squeaky wheel, right? And we sometimes don't ever want to be the squeaky wheel. And we got to get really loud, and we got to get aggressive, you know, and we got to get really, really clear in our moral righteousness about what we want for our children, what we want for our future, and fight for it. Like, I often feel like I say this right now, and I say, as a woman, we are bearing witness to our own oppression. So it is our choice to decide whether we are going to wake up and fight or let this continue to happen to us. You know, things are being not necessarily just done to us, but we are allowing it to happen. And so we need to decide. I mean, you look at what's happening in Afghanistan, in Iran, you know, with the women who are basically, and I would say it's like, we decide, I mean, when Dobbs happened, we should have burned it down, you know? But we continue to think, oh, it's going to get better. Oh, it's not going to be so bad. Oh, they're not going to do that. Oh, that wouldn't happen. And it does, and it does, and it does, and it does.
Yeah, that is just, you know, and we're, you know, I just was thinking that the three of us, each of us has young children who are going to grow up into this world, and we have to fight for them. You know, I mean, we really, like, you know, we have to insist that, like, if someone is trying to ban books, or if someone is trying to restrict the access to information, and this is our job, and it's all parents' job to speak up. And I do think you're just right. We're not organized in the same way. There's no organization nationally that's saying, okay, so you need to get into your school district, you need to get into your school board and really fight back. Or maybe there is, and I just don't know about it.
Rushma,
but I do think
Rushma and Marshall Plans for Moms are going to be right there.
I'm ready. I am ready.
It, right.
Well, don't talk to me about that. Is that it?
Yes,
are you thinking about that?
Absolutely.
I love it. Tell me. No, so tell me all about it. Let's debut. Let's start talking.
You know, it's true, though.
Not debuting, but start talking.
We need to have our own parents' agenda. You know what I mean?
Yes.
For moderate and progressive parents. And we do need to be telling people to run for their school board. We do need to be telling them to fight, you know, for access to information and knowledge and for all these other structural, you know, points we talked about in paid leave and affordable childcare. We need to set our own agenda. You know, it's interesting. You know, you had talked a little bit, Paul, about messaging. And, you know, when I launched the Marshall Plan for Moms, people were like, well, why just moms? What about the dads? And, you know, what we sometimes miss, our people miss, is the emotionality around certain identities. Like, I always say that the proudest thing, the proudest title I wear is mother, period. It is an emotional, strong identity that creates this sense of consensus and shared experience, right? Regardless of whether you're Black, white, gay, trans, you know, binary, rich, poor, right? And so why don't we never lean into that?
No, let's lean into it. I say that as a dad. Like, let's lean into it. I mean, the fact that sensible gun control with Moms Demand, like, great, I'm in.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, like, it doesn't need to be about.
I mean, Paul, that's
let's
such a
go.
Great. That's a great. Sorry, I just have to say this because I think we both like our kids go to the same school, and they had their first shooter drill this week.
Yeah.
And, you know, my baby came home and looked at me and says, I don't want to die, Mom. And I just like it was just like my heart just broke. Right. And I'm not so many parents have experienced this way before. You know what I mean? Forever. We're literally traumatizing our children because we refuse to get guns out of our schools. You know, it's not just Moms to be in action that should be like, we all should be leading this fight, right? We all should be in this fight on them, you know?
Okay, we only have a couple minutes left because both of you are very busy and amazing women who have lots to do. But I do want each of you to say just a couple words about what people should be looking for with your organizations and how they can get involved. So, Sky, can you talk a little bit about what you're doing with Democracy Forward and how people can get involved? And then Rushma, if you can talk about yours.
Sure. Well, thanks, Paul. I mean, look, for people that are feeling despair in this time, and particularly as we look at some of the courts, Democracy Forward, we're here for you, and we want you part of our movement. You can go to our website at democracyforward.org. You can follow us on Twitter at democracyfwd. What we believe is that the vast majority of the American people support progress and democracy, and we are seeking to use their voices in new ways in the courts in order to leverage the power of people at this time. We have seen it work. We have seen it work against all odds. We have seen it work in courtrooms where Trump appointed the judges. We've seen it work in courtrooms where people thought that we were going to lose. And we know that the voices of the American people matter. So come sign up for our updates and learn how to get involved.
And I was just saying, come to MarshallPlanForMoms.com. You know, we're our national movement that is pushing for public and private strategies to help, you know, mothers and families not just survive, but thrive. And so go to our website at MarshallPlanForMoms.com. And, you know, this is a moment to be angry, to be hopeful, but to fight. And if you want to fight with us to make sure that, you know, not only are our kids have access to information, have access to, you know, a world that's going to keep them free, but that we are going to, you know, start elevating and treating moms with the respect and the dignity that they deserve, then we need you.
And I signed up, and I got a great email from Rushma.
Oh, thank you.
Go sign up. People, sign up. We'll be in touch.
A testimony. I just want to say thank you both. You're doing such amazing work. And what I love most is the idea of, like, how do we work together? How do we find ways that different organizations can find
we're
common
on
cause?
We're suing some people together. So. Look for a lawsuit in your neighborhood.
I'm here for it entirely. So thank you both for all you're doing. Thank you for joining us on State of Believe. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's show. I hope these conversations have been valuable to you, both as a validation of the serious concerns you may be feeling, but also as powerful messages of hope as we convene and amplify voices working with urgency and in concert to create strategies and coalitions for defending true American values and religious freedom for all. This is the moment these voices need to be heard as often and as widely as possible, and your support of State of Belief directly contributes to making that possible. I know each of us sometimes can feel frustrated and helpless in the face of what seems to be unrelenting attacks on what we believe this nation was destined to become. I urge you to get involved with the work our guests so passionately talked about, and make sure others have the same opportunity to hear future programs and future opportunities to get involved as well by helping keep State of Belief on the air and help us grow. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Never miss an episode by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And join the conversation. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at State of Belief. And share State of Belief with the people in your life. Email them. Share it on social. Play it with your children. Let's start the conversation wherever you are. State of Belief is produced by Ray Kirstein and is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. I can't wait to introduce you to more amazing people. Until then, I'm Paul Rauschenbusch, and that's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.